Baddow as he relayed the final tragic news that the Polish underground definitely would not come in and that everyone else on the outside was being very quiet about the uprising.
"When I came back," Dove said, "the sewers were filled with people just lying in the muck. They are too weak to stand up. They have no place to go. No one wants them in Warsaw."
And so little Dove returned to the ghetto, and a very strange thing happened. All over Warsaw and the surrounding countryside, Jews who had managed to escape and live as Christians were beginning to return to the ghetto for the last-ditch stand. They had concluded that it was a privilege to be able to die with dignity. May, 1943. At last the furious bombardment stopped. The fires went out. Stroop moved his SS troops in once again. But this time they held all the cards. The Jews had no defensive positions or communications or fixed plans, and almost no food, water, or arms. The Germans worked systematically, cutting off one section at a time and cleaning out bunkers one by one with cannon fire and flamethrowers until the section was completely destroyed. They tried hard to capture prisoners, to torture into revealing the exact location of the bunkers, but the ZOB fighters preferred to burn alive rather than surrender. They threw open the sewer lids and pumped the sewers full of poison gas, and soon the slimy waters were filled with bodies. Still the ZOB fought on. They lashed out of their bunkers on swift and deadly raids when they could find a German patrol. Suicide squads hurled themselves into certain death. German casualties mounted until the number was in the thousands. Stroop pressed on relentlessly. When the Jews became ineffective as a fighting force, they kept going on instinct alone. On May 14th, Mundek held a meeting of the remaining 12 Redeemers in his group. He gave them two choices. One was to remain and fight to the last man. The second was to try the sewers, where Dove might be able to lead them to safety and a remote chance of reaching a partisan unit. Dove convinced Mundek he could work around the areas of the sewers that were being gassed. He made his way in under the wall, but as he approached Zabrowska 99, instinct told him something was wrong. He walked straight past the building. His sharp eye picked out a dozen men who were watching Zabrowska 99 from various vantage points. Dove did not know whether or not Wanda had been taken by the Gestapo, but he did know the place was unsafe. It was late at night when he returned to the ghetto. It was difficult even for him to locate the bunker, for there were no streets or buildings left, only rubble. As he approached, he smelled the now familiar odor of burning flesh. He went beneath the ground and lit a candle he always carried in the sewer. Its flickering light bounced off the walls. Dove walked from one end of the bunker to the other and knelt low with his candle each time he came to a body. Direct hits from the flamethrower had charred the still smoking bodies so badly he could not identify them. Dove Landau wondered which of the burned corpses was his beloved brother, Mundek. May 15th, 1943. ZOB radio broadcast its last message.
"This is the voice of the Warsaw Ghetto. For God's sake, help us."
May 16th, 1943. 42 days had passed since the Germans had made their first attack. 4 months had passed since the ZOB arose and chased the Germans out. As a last gesture, SS General Stroop dynamited the great synagogue on Tlamatska Street. It had long been the symbol of Judaism in Poland. As the Temple of Solomon once fell to the Romans, so had the Tlamatska Synagogue fallen. The Germans announced that the problem of the Warsaw Ghetto had reached its final solution. The devastation had been absolute. Nothing stood in the entire area above a man's eye level. Stroop announced the capture of 16 pistols and 4 rifles. Further, that the ruins of the buildings would make good material. There were no prisoners. Even in this most meticulous of massacres, there were ZOB fighters who refused to die. Even in the rubble, the battle went on. The Jews who had somehow survived began to find each other, and in twos and threes they formed rat packs and attacked German patrols by night. The Germans and the Polish Blues swore the ghetto was haunted by ghosts. Dov found six other Jews. They went from bunker to bunker until they were all armed. They moved from place to place, but the stench and the sight of death was everywhere. At night, Dov led them through the sewers under the wall, where they made quick raids on food stores. The Jews were rebelling in a dozen other places around Poland, but their risings all met with the same fate. Too little, too late, no support. During all the daylight hours, Dov and the six others remained below ground in a newly carved out bunker. For 5 long and harrowing months, neither Dov Landau nor any of his comrades saw the light of day. One by one, they died. 3 on one raid in Warsaw, 2 by suicide, 1 of starvation. Dov was the last one alive. At the end of the 5th month, a German patrol found him close to death. His appearance was not even that of a human being. He was revived sufficiently to be dragged to Gestapo headquarters for questionings, which always ended in beatings. The Gestapo could get nothing from him. Dov Landau, age 13, ghetto rat, sewer rat, rubble rat, and expert forger, was marked for resettlement. Destination: Auschwitz. Chapter 24. Dov Landau was put into an open gondola car with 60 other Jews. The Gestapo refused to believe that he had stayed alive without outside help for 5 months in the rubble of the Warsaw ghetto. The train moved southward over the icy countryside in the dead of winter toward Auschwitz. Berlin, Germany, 1940. SS Lieutenant Colonel Karl Hess entered the office of SS Colonel Eichmann, who had been given the task of carrying out the final solution of the Jewish problem. Eichmann showed Hess the master plan, which was the culmination of the combined brainwork of all the top Nazi officials. The entire continent of Europe was interlaced with concentration camps and political prisons. Every occupied country was well saturated with Gestapo establishments. Another network of 300 combination camps spanned Europe. Half of them were reserved for Jews. SS Lieutenant Colonel Karl Hess was impressed with the intricate planning that went into genocide. Despite all these camps and their carefully chosen locations, the blueprinters felt they were going to run into a special problem. And this was why Hess had been called to Berlin. The Nazis knew they would have tremendous difficulty trying to run extermination camps in Western Europe. Furthermore, Poland was more or less centrally located in relation to the Balkans and Western Europe. A final major camp was needed, one that would serve as a master model. In addition to Jews to dispose of, there were Russian, French, and other prisoners of war, partisans, political enemies in occupied countries, religious fanatics, especially Christians of the Catholic faith, gypsies, criminals, Freemasons, Marxists, Bolsheviks, and Germans who talked peace, liberalism, trade unionism, or defeatism. There were suspected foreign agents, prostitutes, homosexuals, and many other undesirable elements. All these had to be eliminated to make Europe a fit place for Aryans to live. Such a camp as Eichmann spoke of would handle all these people. Eichmann informed Hess that he was to be rewarded for his years of faithful service as a Nazi by being given command of the new camp. Eichmann pointed on the map to a small Polish town near the Czech border, a town called Auschwitz. The train bearing Dov Landau and heading south for Auschwitz rolled to a stop at Krakow, a rail center. At a siding on the outskirts, many more cars were joined to the train. There were cattle cars holding Jews from France and Greece, and coal cars holding Jews from Yugoslavia and Holland, and there were open gondolas holding Jews from Italy for resettlement. It was bitter cold. The biting wind and the snow whipped through Dov in the open gondola, and all that protected him against it was his torn shirt and some little warmth of bodies packed together. Berlin, Germany, 1940-41. When the Nazis selected Hirst to command the camp at Auschwitz, the major clearinghouse and extermination factory, they knew well the caliber of the man they had. Hirst had had a long career in the concentration camp system, beginning way back in 1934, when Hitler first rose to power. More recently, he had been second in command of the concentration camp at Sachsenhausen. Hirst was a meticulous man and systematic, and he carried out orders without questioning them. Furthermore, he was not bothered by hard work. 20,000 acres of land were cleared of farms and villages in the Auschwitz area and fenced off. The best construction men, engineers, scientists, and transportation experts, and the best of the elite stormtroopers went to work on the massive project. An area called Birkenau, 2 miles from the main Auschwitz camp, was selected as the site of the gas chambers. Birkenau was well secluded and had its own rail sidings. The site was picked because of its accessibility by rail from Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and Southern Europe. The little town of Auschwitz was completely undistinguished and lay in a basin of eternal mud at the entrance to the Silesian mining district. In erecting the camp system, the Nazis had to overcome a major objection from their own colleagues. The German army needed all the railroads and rolling stock it could get its hands on to execute a war on the Eastern Front. They did not like this nonsense of using valuable rail space to cart Jews all over Europe. The Nazis were just as adamant that the final solution of the Jewish question was as important as running the war. The question was taken to Hitler, who sided with the SS, SD, Gestapo, and other Nazi elements against the German Army High Command. Hirst assumed command of Auschwitz and traveled to Treblinka to study the methods of extermination. He concluded that Treblinka's commander, SS Colonel Wirth, was a clumsy amateur, and said as much. The executions at Treblinka were carried out with carbon monoxide, which was inefficient. The machinery was always breaking down, and it used up valuable petrol. Furthermore, Wirth was not systematic, and he did not use any measure of deception, so that there were constant rebellions on the part of the Jews. Finally, Hirst felt, Treblinka had been poorly designed if only 300 people could be executed at one time. When the chambers of Birkenau were opened at Auschwitz, Hirst conducted extensive tests on the first guests. He and his scientists concluded that Zyklon B, a crude prussic acid gas, did the job the best. He ordered huge quantities of it from the International Insecticide Company in Hamburg. The Birkenau chambers were designed to hold 3,000 people at one time, and with utmost efficiency, 10,000 people a day could be exterminated, depending on weather conditions. The train bearing Dov Landau was now nearly 50 cars long. It stopped at the town of Krzyżanów, the last before Auschwitz. 1 out of 5 persons on the train was already dead. Other hundreds were frozen to the sides of the cars and unable to move without tearing off the flesh of arms or legs. Many women threw their children over the rail beds and screamed to the curious onlooking peasants to take them and hide them. The dead were removed and stacked in 6 new cars added on at the end of the train. Dov, though in very bad condition, was keen and alert. He knew exactly what to expect, and he knew that if he ever used his wits, he must use them now. The train rolled on again. Auschwitz was an hour away. Auschwitz, 1941-42. Hirsch worked to perfect the operation at Birkenau. First, he worked out a system of deception that would keep the victims calm to the very end. Lovely trees, lawns, and flower beds were planted around the buildings which housed the gas chambers. There were signs everywhere in many languages which read, Sanitation Center. The main deception used was that the victims were going to be inspected and given a delousing shower before being issued new clothing and sent to labor camps at or around Auschwitz. Under and around the gas chambers, neatly laid out dressing rooms had been built. There were pegs with numbers for hanging clothing. Everyone was told to remember his number. Hair was cut for delousing, and the victims were requested to remove their eyeglasses before entering the sanitation shower. Everyone was issued a bar of soap with a number on it. They were marched naked, 3,000 at a time, down long corridors. A dozen mammoth doors ran along the corridors. The doors opened, revealing enormous shower rooms. Most of the guests were too numb to realize quite what was happening, and entered the shower rooms quietly. Some began to examine the bar of soap and found it was made of stone. Others discovered the shower heads on the ceiling were fake and that there was no drainage for water. Often a last-minute panic broke out, but the Germans were ready now with stormtroopers who clubbed and whipped the reluctant into the shower rooms. The iron doors were bolted shut. A can or two of Zyklon B was dropped into each shower room, and it was all over in 10 or 15 minutes. Then came the Sonderkommandos. These were cleanup squads of inmates from Auschwitz. They emptied the gas chambers and removed the corpses to the crematoriums. Gold teeth were pulled and rings taken before the burnings. These would be melted down and sent to Berlin. Often a well-shaped skull would be taken for sale to the German guards as paperweights. Little attention was given to pictures of families or love letters that were found in the clothing. The troopers were most interested in searching through the linings where jewelry was often hidden. Often an infant was found hidden in the clothes and designated for the next shower. Hirsch was good to his troops. They worked hard when a large trainload came to Birkenau and were rewarded with extra rations and schnapps. His system worked with great efficiency, and he never seemed fazed. He did not even get upset when Colonel Eichmann unloaded 250,000 Hungarian Jews on him practically without warning. Hirsch pressed his scientists and engineers for greater efficiency and lower costs. His architects had blueprinted elaborate expansion plans. One was for a gas chamber with a floor that could be lifted hydraulically like an elevator to another level where the crematorium was situated. Other plans were designed to increase the Birkenau capacity to 40,000 executions a day. The greatest bottleneck at Birkenau was the disposal of corpses. At first, they were taken directly from the gas chambers to open fields and buried in pits and covered with lime. The stench became unbearable. The SS troops forced the Jewish Sonderkommandos to dig up all the pits and burn bodies, then crush the bones. Again, open field burning proved too foul-smelling, so inside crematoriums had to be constructed. The train bearing Dov Landau passed through Auschwitz and came to a halt at the siding at Birkenau. Chapter 25. Dov was half-dead with hunger and blue with cold. But his years of constant contact with danger and death had sharpened his instincts so that even in this state he was alert to survive. Dov knew that the next hour would spell life or death. The doors of the cattle and freight cars were opened, and those like him in open cars were ordered over the top with harsh guttural commands. The miserable victims dragged themselves onto a long platform and faced a line of stormtroopers who stood in readiness with clubs, whips, pistols, and vicious dogs straining at their leashes. The The whips cracked out in the cold air and brought screams of pain. The truncheons thudded against skulls, and pistols shot into the bodies of those too weak to walk. A line was formed, four abreast down the length of the platform, and directed toward a huge station room. The line pressed to the room at a slow but steady pace. Doe looked around him. To his left were the trains. Beyond the trains, on the road outside the station room, he could observe a line of waiting trucks. The trucks were not enclosed, so they could not be gas vans, Dove assumed. To his right, past the line of guards, Dove could see the neatly groomed lawns and trees around the brick gas chambers of Birkenau. He studied the shapes of the buildings and their cone-like chimneys, and he knew the area to his right held extermination chambers. The line pressed on. A nausea born of fear racked him. A man staggered and fell, unable to arise. Two snarling dogs were turned loose and ripped the man to pieces. His shrieks set Dove to trembling. He fought to gain control. He knew that he must show no fear. His line moved into the station room. The large line was split into four single lines, and each line moved toward a desk set up at the far end of the room. A German doctor sat behind each desk, and around each doctor stood a dozen guards and assistants. Dove fixed his attention on the desk ahead of him to try to find out what was happening. The doctor quickly looked over every person as he or she stepped to the desk. The doctor would then order the person to go off in one of three directions. The first way was out an exit on the right side of the room. Dove began counting. 7 out of 10 people were sent out that way. These people were old or children or appeared in bad condition. Since he assumed the buildings on the right were gas chambers, he came to the conclusion that those being sent out the right exit were going to be put to death immediately. The second way was out an exit on the left side of the room. This exit led to the outside where the line of trucks was waiting. About 2 out of 10 went that way, and all of them appeared fit and well. Dove assumed they were being sent to the labor camp. The right door meant death, and the left door meant life. There was also a third group. These people, 1 in 10 or even more, were mostly young women, some quite beautiful. A few teenage boys were ordered to join this group. Dove was certain the girls would be used as German field whores and the boys for homosexual activities with the German officers. He drew in a dozen deep breaths as his line inched forward. He was a pack of bones, and he knew he didn't stand much of a chance of being sent through the left exit to the labor camp. In the next line, a woman screamed, and 6 guards converged on her and flung her to the ground and ripped away her skirts. The woman had been trying to hide an infant. "Rights! Rights! Rights! Rights!" The doctor kept ordering the victims. Dov Landau stopped before the desk. The doctor looked up and glanced at him. "Go to that exit on the right," he said. Dov smiled softly.
"You are making a mistake, doctor," Dov said with infinite calm. "I am an expert forger and counterfeiter. Write your name down on that piece of paper, and I'll show you."
The doctor sat back, stunned. Dove's coolness impressed him, for he obviously knew what awaited him. The youngster had put a sudden halt to the monotonous death march. The doctor caught his bearings and a smirk crossed his lips. 2 guards grabbed Dove and began to drag him away.
"Wait!"
the doctor commanded. He looked at Dove again and ordered him to turn around. For a second he became tired of the foolishness. The boy was making a clever bluff. He was about to order him out of the right exit, but his curiosity got the better of him. The doctor scribbled his name on a pad. Dove wrote out 6 duplications of the signature and returned the pad.
"Which one of those did you write?"
Dove asked. 6 guards peeked over the doctor's shoulder and stared in amazement. The doctor looked at Dove again, and then whispered to a guard who walked off.
Stand over here to one side, the doctor snapped.
Doe stood by the desk and watched the line of people move toward him. He looked at them being condemned at the rate of 4 a minute.
Doe looked into the eyes of the guards, and he looked at their truncheons and at the snarling dogs. He glanced at the right-hand exit and whistled a shaky tune half beneath his breath.
5 minutes passed. 10 minutes passed. The line coming in from the platform seemed never to end. The guard returned with another man who was obviously a high-ranking officer, Dove thought, for his chest was filled with medals. The doctor handed the pad of signatures to the officer, who studied it for a full minute.
Where did you learn this? The officer snapped.
In the ghetto at Warsaw.
What kind of work do you do?
Passports, travel cards, any kind of paper. I can duplicate anything.
Follow me.
Dov passed through the left-hand door. As he got into the car and drove off toward Auschwitz am Main, he seemed to remember Mundek's words.
One of the Landaus must live through this.
In a few moments, the car passed through the main gate of Auschwitz. The sign over the entrance of the camp read, Labor Liberates. The main compound was set in an area that wallowed in mud. There was acre after acre of frame wooden barracks, which were isolated from each other by high walls of electrified barbed wire. These acres of barracks fed manpower into some 30 subsidiary slave labor camps. Each inmate wore a black and white striped uniform and an identification color on his arm and left breast. A pink badge was worn by homosexuals, a black badge by field whores, a green badge by criminals, violet badges for clergymen, red for Russians and Poles, and the traditional Star of David for the Jews. Dov received another badge at Auschwitz. It was a tattooed number on his left forearm. Dov Landau was now a black and white striped Jew, number 359195. Labor liberates. Dov Landau celebrated his 14th birthday in Auschwitz, and his gift had been his life. He was quite fortunate, for of all the tens of thousands of prisoners at Auschwitz, Dov's small group of forgers were among the elite. His particular section was given the task of engraving and printing counterfeit United States $1 and $5 bills for use by German agents in Western countries. After a short time at Auschwitz, Dov wondered if it would not have been better to have died at Birkenau. Here the inmates were underfed, worked into living skeletons, and stacked on shelves for their 5 hours' sleep a night. Disease ran wild. Prisoners were tortured, driven insane, beaten, and degraded, and every known atrocity conceived by man was committed. Here each morning found dozens of inmates who had hanged themselves by their own belts or thrown themselves on the quick mercy of the electric wire. The flogging blocks were in constant use, and naked buttocks were lashed in public at roll calls. Here the penal colony lived in single black cells and were fed only oversalted vegetables to induce unquenchable thirst. Here in Block X, Nazi doctors Werther, Schumann, and Klauberg kept the human raw material for their pseudo-scientific experiments. Polish prisoner Dr. Władysław Dering performed castrations and ovarectomies ordered by his German masters as part of their insane program to find a way to sterilize the entire Jewish race. This was Auschwitz, and this was Dov Landau's gift of life. Labor liberates.
One of the Landaus must live through this, Mundek had said. What did Mundek look like?
He could hardly remember. Or Ruth, or Rebecca, or his mother and father. He could not remember his father at all. The memories grew hazier and hazier until he could remember nothing but death and terror, and he did not know that there was a life where death and terror did not exist. A year passed. The trains came in and out of Birkenau. The deaths at the labor camps around Auschwitz from torture and disease and hunger were nearly as appalling as those at Birkenau. Somehow he managed to cling to his sanity and that animal instinct to survive. Even in this blackest of pits, there were some rays of hope. There was the prison orchestra. There was a flourishing underground, and they had a radio receiver. Even here, a man could find a way to get to a woman. Summer, 1944. There was a strange new stirring throughout Auschwitz. Dov could often look into the sky and see Russian bombers, and the secret radio began reporting German defeats. Hope, however dim, found its way through the muck and torture. Each new Allied victory sent the German guards into a murderous frenzy until the prisoners almost dreaded word of German defeats. At Birkenau, activity speeded up until the gas chambers were in operation almost around the clock. Autumn, 1944. The feeling now was that Germany was going to lose the war. They were being beaten on all fronts. But as they lost on the battlefield, the appetite for extermination grew. Colonel Eichmann threw every possible resource into finishing his mission of genocide. October, 1944. The Sonderkommandos at Birkenau staged a wild uprising in which one of the crematoriums was blown up. Each day, in new uprisings, the Sonderkommandos snatched SS guards and their dogs and threw them into the crematoriums. At last, every Sonderkommando was executed, and a call went out for a new group from Auschwitz. His back to the wall, Eichmann made a final gesture. 20,000 Jews, the cream of Jewry, who had been under guaranteed protection at the Czech camp of Theresienstadt, were ordered, transferred to Birkenau for extermination. The Jewish death toll at Birkenau mounted and mounted until the count reached nearly 1 million Poles, 50,000 Germans, 100,000 Dutch, 150,000 French, 50,000 Austrians and Czechs, 50,000 Greeks, 250,000 Bulgarians, Italians, Yugoslavs, and Romanians, and another 250,000 Hungarians. Each day during the macabre race for total annihilation came a call for more and more Sonderkommandos. November, 1944. The counterfeit shop was abruptly closed down in Auschwitz, and everyone was sent to Birkenau to work as Sonderkommandos. It was Dov's new job to wait in the corridor of the gas chambers until a gassing was over. He and other Sonderkommandos stood by until the shrieks of agony and the frantic pounding on the iron doors stopped. They waited another 15 minutes for the gas to clear. Then the doors of the gas chambers would be opened. Dov had to go to work with ropes and hooks to untangle the hideous tangle of arms and legs and drag them out for reshipment to the crematoriums. After the bodies were removed, he had to enter the chamber and hose it down and get the room ready for the next batch of victims who were already in the dressing rooms being prepared. For 3 days, Dov worked at this gory task. Every ounce of his strength was sapped, and now that stubborn, defiant will to live that had carried him through seemed to fade. He dreaded that instant when the iron chamber door opened and he was face to face with the tangle of corpses. He dreaded it worse than the thought of the ghetto or the sewers. He knew he would not be able to stand to see that horrible sight much more often. Then a startling thing happened. The Germans ordered the crematorium ovens dismantled and the gas chambers blown up. The Allies were advancing from the west, and the Russians were coming from the east. Now the Nazis made frantic efforts to cover up their crimes. Pits of bodies were exhumed all over Poland, and the bones crushed and scattered. Desperately needed transportation was used to get the Jews inside Germany. January 22, 1945. The Russian army entered Auschwitz and Birkenau and liberated them. The orgy of murder was over. Dov Landau, aged 15, was one of 50,000 Polish Jews who had kept alive out of 3.5 million. He had kept his promise to his brother. Chapter 26. The Russian army physicians who examined Dov were astonished that he had been able to live through the years of privation and punishment without incurring permanent damage. He was weak and undersized, and he would never have great stamina, but with proper care he could be brought up to reasonable condition. The injury to his mind was something else. The boy had been kept alive by an indomitable spirit. Now that he could relax after 6 years of constant strain, a flood of memories surged through his brain day and night. He became morose and slipped into melancholia, and his mental state approached the thin borderline that separates the sane from the insane. The barbed wire was torn down, and the chambers and the ovens were gone, but the memories would never leave him, and the frightful smell seemed always to hang over him. As he looked at his arm with the blue tattooed number, he relived that grotesque second when the doors of the gas chamber were flung open. Time and time and time again, he saw his mother and his sister Ruth being removed from such a chamber at Treblinka. Time and time again, he held that flickering candle close to the smoldering bodies in the bunker in the Warsaw ghetto and wondered which one was Mundek. Over and over again, he saw the skulls the Germans used as paperweights, as his mother and his sister. The Jews remaining at Auschwitz huddled together in several barracks. Dov could not comprehend that there was a world of the living without depravity and torture. A world of food and warmth and love was beyond him. Even the news of the German surrender brought no scenes of joy at Auschwitz, for there was no joy in victory. Dov Landau's memories festered into hate. He was sorry the gas chambers were gone, for he could visualize lines and lines of German SS troopers and their dogs being marched into them. The war was over, but no one quite knew what to do or where to go. Warsaw? It was 160 miles away, and the roads were clogged with refugees. Even if he got to Warsaw, what then? The ghetto was rubble, and his mother and father and sisters and Mundek were all gone. All of them were dead. Day after day, Dov sat by the window without speaking a word. He stared out at the eternal pall that clung to the Silesian countryside. One by one, the Jews at Auschwitz ventured out to return to their homes. One by one, they came back to Auschwitz with a final, crushing disillusion. The Germans were gone, but the Poles were carrying on for them. There were no cries of Poles for 3.5 million murdered. Instead, the cities were covered with posters, and the people screamed, "The Jews brought this war on us. The war was started so that Jews could make a profit. The Jews are the cause of all our troubles." There were no tears for the dead, but there was plenty of hatred for the few survivors. They smashed Jewish shops and beat up Jews who tried to return to their homes and property. And so, those who ventured out of Auschwitz came back. They sat in the muck-filled compounds, shattered, half-mad, and tragically waited to rot together. The memory of death never left them. The smell from Birkenau was always there. Summer, 1945. A man walked into Auschwitz and was greeted with suspicious snarls. This man was in his early 20s. He was husky and had a big black mustache and wore a snow-white shirt with the sleeves rolled up above the elbows. He walked with a wonderful step that seemed to tell everyone that he was a free man. An assembly was called on the grounds, and they gathered about him. "My name is Bar Dror, Shimshon Bar Dror,"
he called out. I have been sent from Palestine to take you people home.
For the first time in the memory of many, there was an outburst of happiness and tears of joy. Bardror was mobbed with a million questions. Many fell on their knees and kissed his hands, and others just wanted to touch him, to hear him, and to see him. A free Jew from Palestine. Shimshon Bardror, Samson, son of freedom, had come to take them home. Bardror took charge of the compound with a vengeance. He told them that it would be some time before they could move out. But until the Mossad Aliyah Bet found a way for them, they would do better to live like dignified human beings. A new surge of life transformed the compound. Bardror organized committees to put the place into decent shape. School was started, a theatrical group organized, a small orchestra formed and dances held. A daily news bulletin printed and endless discussion carried on about Palestine. Shimshon even started a model farm near the compound to begin agricultural training. Once the new spirit had been instilled and the camp was self-governing, Shimshon Bardror set out on treks in search of other Jews to lead them to the base. As Shimshon Bardror and other Mossad Aliyah Bet agents worked untiringly to gather the Jews together and get them out of Poland, another force was working just as hard to keep them in Poland. Throughout Europe, the British embassies and consulates put pressure on every government to keep their borders closed to these refugees. The British argued that it was all a plot of the World Zionists to force their own solution on the Palestine Mandate. As the undercover battle raged between the British and the Mossad Aliyah Bet, the Polish government issued an astonishing edict. It proclaimed that all Jews were to remain in Poland. The Polish government reasoned that if the few remaining Jews were allowed to leave, they would confirm to the world that the Poles were continuing their persecution, as indeed they were, even after the German extermination program. Thus the Jews were locked in a country that did not want them and locked out of the country that did want them. Winter came to Auschwitz, and morale broke apart at the seams. All the good work of Bardror went for naught. The Palestinian held meetings to try to explain the political battle that raged around them, but the survivors would not listen. They did not care about politics. In the dead of winter, another Aliyah Bet man entered the camp, and he and Bardror made a gambling decision. The two men called the section leaders together and told them to prepare to abandon the camp. We are going to head for the Czech border, Bardror said. It is not too long a journey, but it will be difficult. We can only go as fast as the slowest man, and we must stay off the main roads. Bardror opened a map and traced a route that would take them through the Carpathian Mountains and the Yablunkov Pass, a distance of 70 miles.
What happens when we reach the border?
Someone asked.
We have Aliyah Bet men buying off the Polish border patrol. If we can get through to Czechoslovakia, we will be safe for the time being. Jan Masaryk is a friend. He will not let them chase us out of Czechoslovakia.
They left Auschwitz in the middle of the night, striking off the main road. A tragic line of survivors streaming forth, with the strong holding up the weak and carrying the young. The straggling procession pushed over fields of snow, driving their beaten bodies for 6 harrowing days. Then they drove themselves up into the biting winds of the Carpathian Mountains, with the Palestinians miraculously keeping them all alive and moving them on and on, closer to the border. Along the frontier, other Aliyah Bet men worked feverishly to spread bribe money among the Polish guards. And as the ragged caravan pressed to the boundary, the guards, with their pockets stuffed, turned their backs, and the Jews poured through into Czechoslovakia. On they marched through the freezing cold until they passed through the Yablunkov Pass and assembled at the bottom, exhausted, feet bleeding, hungry, and in need of medical attention. A special train had been chartered by the Mossad Aliya Bet. The escapees were taken aboard to waiting warmth, food, and attention. The first leg of the perilous journey was over. When a Jew entered Palestine legally, he surrendered his passport to the Aliya Bet so that it could be used again. 500 such passports were distributed to the escapees from Auschwitz. In addition to the passports, the Aliya Bet had collected visas for Venezuela, Ecuador, Paraguay, and other South American countries. These documents would hold the British at bay for a while. British CID got wind of the 500 Jews who had crossed from Poland and relayed the news to the Foreign Office at Whitehall. Whitehall sent an urgent dispatch to the British ambassador in Prague to take the matter up with the Czech Foreign Minister, Masaryk, and have the train stopped. The British ambassador was granted an immediate meeting with Masaryk and demanded that the Jews be returned to Poland. He pointed out that the entire Mossad operation was illegal, contrary to Polish law, and had been sponsored by the Zionists in an effort to force the issue over Palestine. Masaryk smiled.
"I do not know much about oil pipelines, Mr. Ambassador," he said, "but I do know about human pipelines."
Masaryk was known to be outspoken in behalf of the Jews. The ambassador implied that British displeasure could be displayed in a more practical manner.
"Mr. Ambassador," Masaryk said, "I will not comply with this or any other British threat. So long as I am Foreign Minister of Czechoslovakia, the borders of my country are open to the Jews with or without visas and with or without passports."
The ambassador reported to Whitehall that the train could not be stopped. It rolled on toward Bratislava, the town where the borders of Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Austria came together. Again, the British attempted to stop it. But this time it crossed into Austria under the personal protection of a sympathetic American military commander. In Vienna, the travelers stopped for much-needed rest and medical attention. They were issued clothing in a giant restaging area that had been established by American Jews to help the European survivors. In Italy, the next stop, the Mossad Aliya Bet had the open cooperation of the public and the Italian officials. But movement was hampered by the fact that the country was occupied by the British. Paradoxically, some of the British occupation forces consisted of units of Palestinian Jews. The Palestine Brigade of the British Army and its units stationed all over occupied Italy had long been considered model troops by the British command. Aliya Bet agents from Palestine integrated with these units, and soon the Palestinian soldiers were busy establishing refugee camps, helping with illegal ships, and the like. For formal purposes, the Palestine units were commanded by army officers. But for practical purposes, the units were under the command of the Aliya Bet and Palmach. Shimshon Bar-Dror had been an army sergeant in one such unit and used his British Army papers to travel back and forth to Poland to round up refugees. It was springtime when Dov's group of Auschwitz refugees embarked on another train that moved into the Austrian Alps and crossed into Italy through the Brenner Pass. The train stopped near Lake Como outside Milan at a very isolated siding. Although the refugees had been warned that they would be met by men wearing British uniforms, panic nearly broke out. The survivors could not comprehend men in fighting uniform wearing a Star of David on their arm. The Star of David had always been the insignia of the ghetto. No Jews, except in the ghetto uprisings, had fought under a Star of David for nearly 2,000 years. They debarked from the train apprehensively. The soldiers were kind, and some spoke Yiddish, and all spoke Hebrew, and they were gentle. But they seemed to be of a different breed of Jew. A week after their arrival in Milan, Dov's group of 100 people were taken from a small camp in the dead of night. They were transported in British trucks driven by members of the Palestine Brigade. The convoy dashed to a secret rendezvous point along the coast, where it met another 300 refugees who had assembled from other camps. From nearby La Spezia harbor, a tiny vessel moved out to meet them. The ship dropped anchor offshore and was loaded by rubber boat. It sailed and got out of the 3-mile limit and was soon trailed by the ever-alert British Navy. There was something baffling about the Gates of Zion. Unlike all the other refugee ships, this one was not heading for Palestine. Its course, instead, was toward the Gulf of Lions on the southern coast of France. Neither the British nor the refugees aboard the Gates of Zion had the slightest idea the vessel was a part of a gigantic plot. Chapter 27 Bill Fry sat at a table at Miller Brothers Restaurant in Baltimore, Maryland. He dropped a handful of oysterette crackers into a big steaming bowl of clam chowder and stirred it. He toyed with the soup for a moment, but he had no appetite. Jesus Christ, he thought. I wonder if I can get that piss pot across the Atlantic Ocean. Bill Fry had earned a reputation as the most successful captain in the Mossad Aliyah bet. His beaching of the Star of David at Caesarea had opened a new era in the illegal immigration war. It had forced the British to start the Cyprus detention camps. This had been a turning point, for the Mossad had run one shipload after another into Palestine as fast as the British turned them back, and now another crisis was brewing. Mossad Aliyah Bet had run in so many illegals that the camp in Cyprus was bursting. Flushing with success and determined to break the British exclusion policy, the Mossad dreamed up a wild scheme and chose Bill Fry to execute it. The largest of the illegal fleet to date had been his Star of David, which carried under 2,000 passengers. Other ships carried from a few hundred to 1,000. The Mossad figured that if they could run the blockade with a ship holding upwards of 5,000 refugees, it would be a staggering blow for the British. Bill was commissioned to find a ship that could do the job, outfit it, and take 5,000 refugees from the big center at La Ciotat in southern France. It was felt that the ship should be purchased in the United States or South America, where the British would not be suspicious. British CID simply had the European ports too well covered. Mossad agents covered South America while Bill himself searched the Gulf ports and the East Coast. It became obvious that they weren't going to get much of a ship for the money they had to spend. So Bill had taken a gamble, and now he was worried. He had purchased an overaged, obsolete steamship, which had seen service only on the Chesapeake Bay in an overnight run between Baltimore and Norfolk. The ship, the General Stonewall Jackson, an oversized pleasure cruiser, had never sailed the ocean. The only thing Bill could think of that was decent about the ship was that it had been bought cheap. The white-coated waiter hovered over Bill's table. "Is something wrong with the chowder, sir?"
"Huh? Oh, hell no. It's fine," he mumbled, and shoved a spoonful into his mouth.
Had the purchase of the obsolete Bayliner been a mistake? At this moment, it was being fitted in Newport News, Virginia, to hold 6,850 refugees. Bill sighed. There was the other side of the picture. Suppose he could get 7,000 refugees out of Europe at one crack. It would just about explode the British policy. Bill shoved the bowl of chowder away and asked for the check. He picked up the dead cigar butt from the ashtray and relit it, and once again read the telegram from Newport News. The Jackson is ready. At Newport News the next day, Bill assembled his crew of Palestinian Palmach and Aliyah Bet, American Jews, sympathetic Spanish loyalists, Italians, and French. He inspected the ship and ran a short shakedown cruise around the lower bay, then revved up her engines and made for the Atlantic Ocean. Within 3 hours, the Jackson developed engine trouble and had to return to Newport News. During the next 2 weeks, Bill made 3 more attempts. The moment the old ship got far from her natural habitat, she rebelled and had to be taken back to port. Bill told the Aliabet people he had made a mistake. The Jackson simply could not make it. They urged him to check her over in dock for another week and make one last try. On the 5th attempt, the entire crew held its collective breath as the obsolete steamer chugged past Cape Henry into deep waters of the Atlantic, and continued to chug. 22 days later, the Stonewall Jackson wheezed up the Gulf of Lions to the French harbor of Toulon, which stood 40 miles from Marseille and only 20 miles from the big refugee camp of La Ciotat. There had been a teamster strike in France, and the British CID who were watching La Ciotat relaxed for a moment, assuming that there would be no movement without trucks. Furthermore, there had been no reports of illegal ships coming from any European ports since the Gates of Zion, Doe's ship, had landed at Port de Boue several weeks earlier. The British were caught napping. They had no advance notice of the Jackson because she had been purchased and fitted in the United States, and to date, no Aliabet ship had been large enough to navigate the Atlantic. When the Jackson was due to arrive at Toulon, the Aliabet went to the head of the French Teamsters Union and explained the situation. The Teamsters' head secretly rounded up drivers and trucks, and during the middle of their strike, they rushed in and out of La Ciotat, transporting 6,500 refugees to Toulon. Among them, Dov Landau. British CID discovered the secret at the last moment and descended upon Toulon. They passed out enormous bribes to port officials to delay the departure of the Jackson long enough for them to contact London for instructions. Mossad Aliabet men made counter-bribes to the officials to get the ship on the seas, and the Jackson, now renamed the Promised Land, ran the blue and white Star of David to her mast top in open challenge. Hasty meetings took place at the Admiralty, Chatham House, and Whitehall. The implications of the situation for British policy were clear, and it was obvious that the Promised Land had to be stopped at all costs. The British issued angry threats to the French. British warships waited outside Toulon. The French answered by granting permission to the Promised Land to sail. The Promised Land set out from Toulon mid the cheers of the refugees aboard her. The instant she passed the 3-mile zone, she was escorted by 2 waiting British cruisers, the Apex and Dunstan Hill. For the next 3.5 days, Bill Fry steered the Promised Land straight for Palestine. Her long, thin smokestack puffed, and her engines groaned, and her decks bulged, and her watchdog cruisers watched. The Apex and Dunstan Hill kept in constant radio contact with the Admiralty in London. As the Promised Land edged to within 50 miles of the Palestine coast, the British broke the rules of illegal blockade. The Apex came close to the steamer and sent a salvo over her ancient bows. The cruiser's bullhorns blasted, and her loudspeaker sent a voice over the water. "Illegal ship! Stand by to be boarded!" Bill Fry bit his cigar. He grabbed a megaphone and stepped onto the bridge.
"We're on the high seas," he shouted. "If you board us here, it will be piracy."
"Sorry, chaps, just following orders. Are you going to accept a boarding party peacefully?"
Bill turned to his Palmach chief, who was standing behind him.
"Let's give these bastards a reception."
The Promised Land turned on full steam in an attempt to sprint away from the cruisers. The Apex moved alongside her, then cut in sharply, and her steel bow rammed the ancient steamer amidships. The blow splintered deep into the steamer's hull over the waterline, and she shuddered under the impact. The Apex sent out machine gun fire to drive the refugees off the deck and make it clear for a landing party. British Marines, wearing gas masks and carrying small arms, poured over the bow of the Promised Land and moved back to the superstructure. Palmachniks unrolled accordions of barbed wire in the path of the British, and then loosed a barrage of rocks on them, followed by streams of water from pressure hoses. The British were swept back to the bow by the attack. They fought off the Palmach with small arms and called for reinforcements. More Marines boarded, this time with wire cutters. Another attack mounted toward the superstructure. Again the water hoses pushed them back, and again the British returned, under cover of machine gun fire from the apex. They reached the barbed wire and cut it, in time to receive scalding steam jets from the Palmach. Now the Palmachniks jumped to the attack and drove the British back. They overpowered the Marines and threw them into the sea, one by one. The Apex stopped the attack to fish their men out of the water, and the Promised Land, a huge hole in her side, chugged off once again. The Dunstan Hill chased her down and pondered the advisability of another ram. The steamer might well go down with one more blow. It was too dangerous to risk. Instead, the Dunstan Hill poured on heavy caliber machine gun fire that raked the decks clean of refugees and Palmach. The Dunstan Hill's boarding party came up amidships on ladders. A wild hand-to-hand brawl followed. With flailing clubs and an occasional pistol shot, the British pressed the attack toward the ladder leading up to the captain's bridge. Meanwhile, the Apex recovered and raced to the scene again. The two cruisers boxed the steamship in. The Apex party boarded again behind a tear gas barrage, and with the Dunstan Hill Marines pressing from the other direction, the Palmach was driven back. Dov Landau was in the fight. He and other refugees were guarding the top of the ladder near the captain's bridge. They pushed the British down the ladder half a dozen times until the tear gas and finally small arms drove them off. The British had control of the deck now. They reinforced their position and held the refugees and Palmach